Welcome to Holden Village. In the Creekside room, this morning's speaker is Paul Bosch on the 26th of July, 1995. And he will be speaking on worship, post-Constantinian, post-Gutenberg, pre-technology. So let's listen in on Paul.
I wrote a book long ago where I said Bonhoeffer was wrong. And what I meant by that was kind of a smart-ass way of speaking. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in one of his writing somewhere, says that what we need and what the world is moving toward is a religionless Christianity. And he was reflecting, I think, the notion from Barth that religion is human construction, whereas the biblical faith is not what we do to climb up a ladder into heaven, but what God does coming in our midst. And I can understand that critique, and I can appreciate it and say, yes, at Barth's time that word was needed, and maybe even in Bonhoeffer's time that word was needed. Bonhoeffer foresaw an age, apparently, where people were just not religious anymore. But I think he has been proved wrong. If that was his notion, and maybe it's Bonhoeffer's interpreters who are wrong more than Bonhoeffer, but it seems to me that religion is not going away. And religion is for good and for bad. In other words, not every religion is a wholesome religion, in my view. Not every crazy technology, I hate it. Luddites. You know what Luddites are? Have you heard of that term? A Luddite from Ned Ludd, who went around, I think he's a mythical figure, somebody said, but his followers anyhow went around and smashed the early Industrial Revolution weaving mills, weaving machines, because they thought it was going to put all these little cottage industries out of business. So a Luddite is somebody who hates technology. And there's a good bit of that in me, and we'll get to that later this morning. But anyhow, it seems to me religion is not going out of style. You have all these crazy New Age things. You have a lot of sympathy these days for Eastern religions and you know, all kinds of kooky possibilities are out there, which attract percentages of the population anyhow. Gail Ramshaw, any of you know Gail? She maintains that a guy like Joseph Campbell, for instance, who's interviewed by Bill Moyers on public television and so on, is you know, as responsible as much as anybody for bringing religion back into being a good word, you know, not a dirty word any longer. Barth saw the word religion as a pejorative. But people like Joseph Campbell and the ritual studies people of our own day have kind of redeemed that word and brought the word back into current use and to a certain amount of respectability that I would be willing to endorse. Gail says that Campbell is frankly anti-Christian. I haven't seen much of his stuff, nor even read much of his stuff. But he seems to imply, according to Gail anyhow, that all the Eastern religions have it right and the Christian faith has it wrong. In any case, I think you can redeem the word religion and say, sure, it's human. It's anything human beings do in a ritual way that gives significance to their lives. And I would argue that there's a difference between ritual and routine. Ritual is something you do over and over again that you would miss if you didn't do it. And routine is something you do over and over again that you would not miss, like taking out the garbage every Tuesday. Every Tuesday, you have to, in my town, you have to put out the garbage. And if I didn't have to do that, my life is not enriched by that action. But my life is enriched by a lot of other rituals that I surround myself with. Some are very personal and private. Some are more corporate. The 4th of July Patriotic Parade is a corporate ritual. The opening night at the symphony orchestra season is a corporate ritual. Surely the university has plenty of corporate rituals with baccalaureate and commencement and all that kind of stuff. So ritual is simply part of human life, and I would argue, and I think Joseph Campbell argues and others argue as well, that people are by nature ritual makers, ritual enactors. So we don't have to be embarrassed by that, but we do have to be careful that our ritual is transparent to the gospel. I don't see an age, I do not see an age when people will cease to need ritualizing. And the problem with ritual is, of course, that it always has the threat of becoming routine. And that includes Christian rituals, too. Christian rituals can be debased, and we'll talk about some of that, as a matter of fact. Where are we here? I think we can take that word religion and accept it. Yeah, sure, Christianity, Christian faith, in a sense, has its religious its religious side and its religious trappings, but they're always under the judgment of the gospel and always under the judgment of the biblical tradition and the so-called what I would call Catholic tradition, small c. So let us take a look at worship in post-Christendom. I would argue, and it's not just me, but others too, that we are living in a post-Constantinian, post-Christendom age. And the age of Christendom began in, 360-whatever with Constantine, when Constantine made Christianity the religion of the empire. Up until that time, Christianity had been at first vaguely tolerated and then actively persecuted. And when Constantine was himself converted and he made Christianity the religion of the empire, then right away the Christian faith for the first time really had legitimacy, and that meant power and prestige and privilege. Now that age, I think, has come to a close, or is fast coming to a close in a lot of places, including Western Europe and North America. And we are living in a much more pluralistic world. You know, the high schools and grade schools can't celebrate Christmas anymore the way they did when I was a kid. City Hall doesn't put the manger scene up anymore, at least in a lot of communities. And I affirm all that. I mean, I think we live in a pluralistic age, and we ought to acknowledge that there are lots of other religions out there besides the Christian faith. In any case, it's a new age, and our time is much more like our era today is much more like the 4th century, let's say, than it is like the High Middle Ages or even the Victorian Age, when everybody assumed that Western civilization equals Christian. I don't think we can assume that anymore. And I cited this statistic the other day. The Northwest, Washington and Oregon in the United States, those two states are the most secular in the nation. Carol Hinderly used to say that way back in the early days of Holden Village. The statistics, I don't have his statistics, but would you have them, any of you?
On any given Sunday morning, 95% of people in the state of Washington are not in church.
95%.
That's, I mean, there's, so 5% are regular churchgoers. 19 out of 20 are staying home on Sunday morning. Now, there's a lot more who are members of congregations, but regular Sunday morning churchgoers is about 5%.
The 5% would be composed of the regulars plus some irregulars, wouldn't it?
that may be true, too. Make it even worse. Oh, dear, dear. The statistics were pretty low, too, in the colonial days, let's face it. Washington and Jefferson and Franklin and those people, you know, boy, the statistics for church going in those days were very low as well. So this is not new to us. But
in those days, as I understand it, church membership was low, was even lower than church. I think it was a church membership that was low then. Church going was actually higher. As I understand, it was a different
That's interesting.
View of things. You didn't join the church until you had reached a certain level of faith, and then you felt that you were worthy to join the church, but people attended at a greater level than joining, which is
Isn't that interesting?
Upside down.
Yeah, crazy.
The way we are now.
Anyhow, good old Bill Lazarus has a neat little phrase. He's a phrase maker, among other things. And he says, there are practical implications in our theology, and there is theological force in our practice. And I kind of like that. It's another way of saying lex orandi, lex credendi. In other words, there is practical implications in what we believe. Practical implications for worship, let's say. If we believe certain things, then we ought to design our worship in a certain way. The flip side of that is also true, that there are theological, there is theological force in our practice, in what we do. What we do on Sunday morning teaches people. And I would maintain that all the arts as well communicate and teach. And I put on the board yesterday the statistic, 55% nonverbal, 38% vocal, 7%, dear friends, words. So all of that experience, we should certainly be careful about our words, but I am here to plead with you to be equally careful about everything else that goes on Sunday morning. Whenever we gather to worship, the architectural setting, the architectural arrangement, the gestures, the postures, the kind of book you use or don't use, it pains me to see, as we have here at Holden Village, people standing up and reading the scripture out of some flimsy pamphlet. You know, they should read out of a nice big book with hub binding and gold page edges and ribbon markers. I mean, that gives honor to the stuff of creation, in my view. And to read scripture out of a throwaway pamphlet is simply not giving proper incarnational honor to the stuff of the world. So the arts, you could say, architecture and drama, investments even, and all that nonverbal stuff, and also, of course, the vocal, as well as the verbal, all of that is certainly adiaphora from one perspective. It's neither commanded nor rejected. God doesn't care whether the pastor is dressed in pajamas. If the pastor's dressed in pajamas, though, he's got some explaining to do. And since you're going to be dressed in something, it seems to me you could make a case, as I would anyhow, for the historic vestments. And whatever you wear is going to be exotic to some people. The entertainment evangelism people say, why wear vestments? Why come to church as a leader, that is, the leader of worship? Why should he walk in the church dressed like a Roman senator? Well, I think you could argue that there are, well, let me get into them. Three good meanings. Three uses for what I would call the sign. Whatever you see in terms of dramatic action, or in terms of candles, or in terms of the book that's used or whatever. It seems to me there are three burdens of meaning there, what I will call the utilitarian or functional, the symbolic or pedagogical, to teach, and then the historical as well. The did I spell that right? Utilitarian. Candles are meant to illuminate. Candles are meant to illuminate. In the Middle Ages, they were necessary. We didn't have electricity, and you needed candles to illuminate the worship leader's task. And so we ought to place candles, and the candles ought to have the size and the scale and the placement in the church so as to let that happen. And symbols that merely are decorative don't have the power in people's lives that really functional symbols do. To put a loaf of bread and a cup on the altar and keep it there throughout the week, I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. You put out food to eat, and when the meal is through, you take it away. Same with having a book open to Psalm 117, covered with dust, and never read from. You know, you ought to read from that book that's up there. I think the lectern is the place. You could make a shrine out of the lectern, as a matter of fact, as some Roman Catholics do. They have the book either open or closed, sitting on a shrine visible in the front of the lectern, and that's kind of nice. But on Sunday and in services, it ought to be read from. That book ought to be functional. What's that? Not from a pamphlet. No, definitely not. So that's the functional reason, and you could even say vestments have a functional reason. They direct the attention of people who are worshiping away from the leader's idiosyncrasies, whether it's a patched knee or looming buns or whatever. Vestments draw attention away from those idiosyncrasies and toward the event that's being celebrated, and I would argue that that's a utilitarian functional purpose that we ought to listen to. Then, of course, symbolic or pedagogical, you have an opportunity to teach. And you can say, hey, candles, that's a symbol of the light of the world. And vestments, you know, the stole is the symbol of my preaching authority. And the chasuble is the symbol of the meal, the heavenly banquet. So you have an opportunity to teach. Same with the colors of the church year. Advent is different from Christmas. Christmas is different from Lent. Lent is different from Easter. And, you know, you have opportunities to teach with all that stuff, and I think that's wonderful.
What do you say about some of the stoles they're doing now that are really kind of an art piece?
Ah.
In my mind.
Uh-huh. You have some...
I don't care what color it is, if it's...
Oh.
Yeah. They're putting on the one that they got from Guatemala or something.
Yeah, I see. I suppose you could cluck your tongue about that. I think I would prefer to see the color code honored in some way or other. On occasion, I don't think I would mind a multicolored, that's what you're complaining about, or that you're...
Well, even yeah. I think some of it's just strictly designed.
Yeah. Just being decorative is not sufficient, I don't think, for church use, for worship use. For something simply to be decorative, that's not a sufficient reason.
Some people said, I like your stole. I said, well, look at this. It's got the wheat and it's got the vine.
Yeah.
So it's talking about
you. Yeah, that you got an opportunity to teach there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The third purpose then would be historic. That is to say, you stand in historic progression and procession. And Martin Luther would recognize those vestments, let's say. St. Francis would recognize them. I have a pastor friend, he says, when I put on these vestments, I am 2,000 years old. I like that. I mean, you know, we ought to honor that history. To be a contemporary person, you do not have to be Oedipus. You do not have to kill your father or mother. You know, you do not have to reject what grandpa and grandma held dear. And one of the definitions of tradition is a way of giving your grandpa and grandma a vote in the decisions that you must make today. And I like that, transgenerational democracy. Well, not the only vote, not the deciding vote, but at least a vote.
You can go beyond that when we sing glory to God, what you're doing, you're joining the
angels and archangels, yeah, sure.
Birth of Christ.
Yeah, wonderful. So I would hold up these three arguments for almost any signs, quote unquote, that we might want to use in church. We ought to be conscious of the utilitarian function of it, first of all, and always have that standing forth pretty clearly. We ought to be taking advantage of the pedagogical and symbolic opportunity that we have there, and we ought to be conscious of the history that we're representing. Okay, moving along. Eyes that see, ears that hear. If we don't do any of this, you know, you could make a case that worship ought to be very egalitarian and the worship leaders don't wear any different clothes from the worshipers in the pew. I would maintain that the people in the pew, the community of believers, is the important voice in worship. And the pastor and the worship leaders and the musicians and the organist and the choir and so on, they are prompters to the people's praise. put in another term, the people are the team on the field. And the pastor and the musicians and the worship leaders and so on, they're the cheerleaders. And it's God who's in the stands. He's also on the field. You're mixing up the analogies, but that we're stuck with it, I think. Anyhow, I think that's the important thing to remember. The Holy Communion is not just bread and cup. Holy Communion is people. That's a collective noun. The Holy Communion is people. So the people in the pew and their voice, that's the important thing. Now, if you have, as I say, altogether austere worship, are you familiar with the two words, cataphatic and apathetic? I learned them a couple years ago, and I got a bone spur, so you'll see me limping around here like an old man. I never heard these words before, but I thought they were kind of useful. Cataphatic and apathetic represent two apathetic. They represent two poles, you might say, on a continuum. You could have another continuum here. This is from Urban Holmes. And he says, everybody's spirituality can be plotted somewhere on that grid. You want to have a service, or you want to have worship that inspires the mind, or do you want to have worship that teaches the heart? You know, and you could probably place yourself somewhere on that continuum. Okay, cataphatic and apophatic is with form and without form. So, for instance, Eastern Orthodox worship with smells and bells and incense and chanting and vestments and all that, that would be pretty far over here on the cataphatic scale. Apophatic, Quaker and Mennonite. You know what I mean? Very austere, very simple. A guy like Jensen, Robert Jensen and Carl Broughton, they maintain that Christianity is by nature cataphatic. I mean, it's incarnational. And you get too far over to this end of the continuum, and you're not Christian anymore. I mean, we're talking word and sacraments, you see. Signs and words, forms, hymns, liturgies, creeds even, vestments, candles, you know, all that stuff is cataphatic. And, says Broughton and Jensen, we can't do without it. And, he says, you find Quakers, not so much Mennonites, but Quakers anyhow, who are really pretty Buddhist, and have kind of, because they are so apophatic, because they have, are so suspicious of forms, suspicious of liturgies, suspicious of hymns, suspicious of candles and symbols like that, and vestments and so on. They are so suspicious of it that they become suspicious of the incarnational realities that go along with Christian faith, that God comes in the flesh among us, and they become so spiritualized that you can't recognize them as Christian anymore. So I think they have a point there. So I think Jensen and Broughton have a point. Well, using all of the stuff that we have now, the signs that are available to us, I would say we've got three good reasons for that as well. We miss a marvelous teaching opportunity if we don't make use of them. We muzzle an important voice that wants to speak if we don't use them. Let's take flowers, for instance. Some churches invariably have flowers on the altar or in the chancel somewhere all through the church year. I would argue, let's let the florist's art speak to us. And on Ash Wednesday, let's not have flowers, let's just have dried sticks, artfully arranged. And all during Lent, let's have no flowers, just greens. And all during Advent, let's have no flowers, just evergreens, maybe. Then at Christmas, bring the flowers in, poinsettias and so on. At Easter, bring in the lilies and the, what are they? anyhow, put flowers in there. In other words, let the florist's art speak to us. That's a voice, I think, that's a voice that wants to be heard. And the same with other art forms as well. If we don't make use of these art forms, it doesn't mean we're not going to use anything. Christianity, as I say, at least is minimally cataphatic, if not maximally cataphatic, and we need to have these. If you're not worshiping in this church, you're worshiping in another church. Or if you're not worshiping in a church at all, you're worshiping in a space like this, and you're arranging the chairs in a certain way. And the way you arrange the chairs speaks. Basically, there are two ways of arranging chairs, if we want to talk about architecture for a minute. Next week, incidentally, we'll have a series on the arts and worship, and I'm going to actually take my class over and push furniture around in the village center. I still have to get permission for that, however. Basically, radial and axial. And you know the name Rudolf Schwarz, great church architect from, I think he's dead now, but he's contemporary, European. He has a book called The Church Incarnate, and he lays out with his own drawings, wonderful drawings, seven possible architectural arrangements for churches from what he calls the sacred, the sacred circle to a sacred journey. This is sacred circle, this is sacred journey. This is basically people gathered around a center. This is basically people heading on a journey. And you could make a case that both sermons are valid enough in Christian, in Christian tradition. These people only see the back of each other's heads, and you got the problem of making it look like a theater. You know, giving people the wrong impression that they're sitting as an audience, and these people up here are putting on a show for them. So there are basic problems, I think, with any kind of axial arrangement. But at its best and at its purest, it could be thought of as a sacred journey toward the New Jerusalem. God is out there ahead of us somewhere. And the leaders are first in the procession, and the army follows the leaders. So you could make a case, I think, that that's a valid Christian sermon that this is speaking. Transcendence. I never was a very good star. Okay, radial is imminence, God in our midst. Whatever, take your choice. This transcendence means the God as other, God as different, God as apart from us, God as ahead of us, God calling us on. This axial type of church or worship arrangement doesn't have to be a church building. We could do that here, you see. I think it's significant that we did not do that here. We did this in this room. Radio. That speaks of God in our midst. Further, it has the advantage that I can look you in the face, you can look me in the face. And so this kind of an arrangement is an arrangement that speaks of community. And I think the 20th century needs more of these kind of churches and fewer than these. Fewer of these. Now, one of the worship here, so you'd have to vary it. And as I say, Rudolf Schwarz has seven variations all the way from this to this, including a half circle, people on three sides, thrust stage. Same thing is happening in theater these days, as you may know. The proscenium stage, you know what I mean by a proscenium stage? You sit in an audience in chairs, and up front there is a box with the fourth wall removed, and you're looking through that fourth wall at a stage set. That's a proscenium stage. And those kind of theaters are just not being built anymore. In almost every case, theaters that are being built these days are at least a thrust stage, that is to say, the stage sticking out into the congregation, into the audience, and the audience on three sides, like Stratford, Minneapolis, Tyrone Guthrie Theater, places like that, or even Circle in the Round, theater in the round. Very exciting worship. very exciting theater. Anyhow, we miss a teaching opportunity if we don't use this kind of stuff. We muzzle a voice that cries out to speak, and as you might guess, we're cheating our people, in my view. Now, let's take a look at post-Gutenberg. Marshall McLuhan and other people like that say we are in a post-Gutenberg age. He may mean somewhat different from that. He may have something else in mind. What I have in mind is that printed texts are almost always a nuisance, at the very least, in worship. And at their worst, they just are deadly in worship. I suppose we will always need hymn books. But it's curious, we've lived in Kentucky for 9 months now, 10 months most recently, and we had a tour of Eastern Kentucky back in October. The college provided a tour for new faculty and their spouses, new administrators and so on, and their spouses. And we went into the hill country. And we went in a coal mine on Monday morning, and we went into what they call settlement schools from the 20s and the 30s. I mean, it was a fascinating old hillbilly log cabin way back in the woods. On Sunday morning, we went to an old regular Baptist church. You've never heard of the old regular Baptists, I dare say. But they, according to one of a theologian friend of mine, they are pure Calvinists from long, long ago. No hymn books. No printed guide to worship. Nothing in the people's hands. All the hymns were lined out. 2.5-hour service. 5 sermons. It was wonderful. And the space was arranged radially. I mean, it was very interesting. And they've got something to teach us. Now, it was give your life to Jesus. You know, it was tending toward fundamentalism. But it's a very interesting experience to me. And it proved to me that you don't need all this printed stuff that we put in front of people. I think worship at its best is post-Gutenberg. Now, you need hymn book, I suppose, to sing a hymn or to check out the psalm. But the liturgy you should know by heart. And to put a text in front of people and to expect people to read great, that's no good. The flip side of our time at the old regular Baptist church was to attend on frequent occasions the Union Church in town. It was kind of an independent congregation, very well educated members and well-educated pastoral leaders as well. But every Sunday they would put some new printed stuff in your hand, you know, in the bulletin. And the people in the pew were expected to read this long paragraph of prayer or whatever it was, or even responsive reading. And that freezes out the blind, the illiterate, and what are the percentages of functional illiterates in our society. It freezes out children. We ought to have other ways of making worship hospitable, even to the blind, even to the illiterate, even to little kids. And printed texts almost always get in the way. Further, they give the signal, this is going to be tough. This is going to be difficult. You're going to have to read, and you're going to have to juggle the book and the paper, and you're going to have to flip to different pages in the book and so on. We ought to find ways of doing without that, I think.
The Psalms were really pre-Gutenberg.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got a little irritation that, you know, the way to print them now, that you do the one person or one side does one verse and the other does the next verse. And really, almost every one of those should be split, so that they see the Hebrew poetry involved. I don't think you can ever quite learn to do it, but boy, if you begin to realize the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me laugh.
Yeah, antiphonal type stuff, yeah.
And
yeah.
by half verses instead of this whole verse
thing. Maybe even the best kind of psalms are the Jelano type thing, where the people have a single refrain to repeat, and then there are cantors or choir who sing the verses. And again, in the old days, in the Middle Ages, it was the worship leaders who were expected to be the literate ones. And you paid them to be literate for you. And we were in church, my own home church, as a matter of fact, wonderful pastor with a very great sensitivity to this kind of stuff, and a musician besides. And we were singing, "Sing praise to the Lord, sing praise to the Lord, all the earth." Now that was the psalm response for the people in the pew. And he just taught that to us on the spot. There was nothing in the bulletin even. "Sing praise to the Lord, sing praise to the Lord, all the earth." And the organ was behind it, and oh, wonderful. And then the cantor sang the verses, and we had that response after each verse. It was wonderful. So we ought to do more of that kind
of thing.
That's
the old antiphon.
Yeah, exactly, antiphon. We ought to have more of that. So, post-Constantine, post-Gutenberg. Now, how about post-technology? Well, I had actually in my title, pre-technology. You can't be pre-technology or post-technology for that matter. Everything is a technology. Candles are a technology. How long have we got to go? Till 11:30? Is that right? Do we go till 11:30?
Yeah.
You know, you can't escape technology, but I would argue that most modern let me back up a moment. I will argue that Americans, North Americans particularly, are obsessed with technology. And any new thing that comes down the pike, North Americans have to have it. And they think right away, let's put it in our church too. And I think that's a mistake. A lot of modern technology, when put to use in worship, is simply terrible. Even wall-to-wall carpeting. I was on the dish team this morning, and I was back in the pit washing out those big kettles that they make the bread in and so on. And we took a full hour and a half at it, and the floor was just a slew of garbage water. Now the floor was quarry tile. It could easily have been slate, I suppose, or even concrete for that matter, and there was a drain in it. And at the end, we just hosed it down. And I said, wonderful, our churches should be like that. Gordon Lathrop says, after a baptism, we should use sufficient water that the janitor knows that something's happened. And wouldn't it be neat if we could just hose the chancel down? I mean, that'd be great. Churches ought to have, in my view, and not just my view, but I think I'm telling you here the ecumenical consensus, the point of these four sessions with me, beginning with Monday and yesterday and today, and now we meet again next time on Saturday. I don't see you tomorrow or Thursday.
Tomorrow
or Friday. Tomorrow is Thursday. But the point of these four sessions is to put before you what I'm calling an ecumenical consensus about worship. We're living in a time when there is exciting convergence among all the churches, and it's represented in this little book that I flagged that you can get in the bookstore, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, the World Council of Churches, a document that represents all the major church traditions, Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Old Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, Reformed, Presbyterian, Methodist, United, Disciples, Baptist, Adventist, and Pentecostal. All of them coming up with asking similar questions and coming up with similar answers about these three things: baptism, Holy Communion, and ministry. And then also in the bookstore, for whatever it's worth, the beginning volumes, I think there are three now, Open Questions in Worship. And my contribution is in this little thing called What is Contemporary Worship? But there's a third one now. Frank Sen has one in there. How does worship evangelize? Anyhow, I am laying before you in these sessions what I take to be an incredible consensus and agreement about what Christian worship is, what it ought to look like, how we ought to design our churches, whether we should put carpet down or not, or should it be quarry tile, that kind of thing. And Not since before the Reformation have we seen that kind of agreement. And I'm here to tell you that the people I read and the people I speak to say that wall-to-wall carpeting is a mistake in a church. One, for acoustic reasons. The organists and choirs just hate it. But two, for the reason of the soup kitchen. I mean, it ought to be the church ought to be a public space and not a domestic space. I think let's put an oriental rug in the chancel at the altar. But let's not put down wall-to-wall carpeting. The church, in my view, a church building ought to be open during the day for people to come in and pray. Now, Roman Catholics can get away with that, you'll tell me, because they have a big staff and lots of clergy and people are always in and out. You know, people who are attached to the building, that's true. What about our churches where you got a part-time secretary that's there for a couple of hours in the morning? I don't know. I just yearn for our buildings to be open the way Roman Catholic buildings are. And technology like microphones and so on, terrible. Overhead projectors, terrible. Don't belong in the church, I don't think. I have a friend who says if a church is so big that it needs a PA system, it's too big. We should hear the naked human voice. Rule Howe, do any of you know that name? Rule Howe, wonderful preacher, Anglican, Episcopal, had this Institute for Advanced Pastoral Studies in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. And I sat at his feet for a week long ago, and he said, one of the troubles with carpeting, wall-to-wall carpeting in a church is you are insulating yourself against hearing the click of the worshiper's heels as they go down the aisle to the altar. And he says, that click is proclaiming the gospel. Isn't that wonderful? And he says, you put carpeting down and you don't hear it. We attended a church. I had a study lead that took us to England, and I attended a Church of England church down the street. Wonderful picture of the Catholic community. This was a very mixed neighborhood, and you had Pakistanis and East Indian, West Indian Jamaicans, and as well as white Brits and so on. And they were all in this church, old and young. It was wonderful. And at the time of the offering, they had these bags on the end of a pole, you know, the ushers. And you, back in the old days, I think they've changed their money system now, but when we were there anyhow, the penny was a great big copper thing like this. And they would collect the offering in these bags, and then they would bring them forward at the offertory, and there was an acolyte standing at the foot of the chancel steps with a great big bronze basin, and they would dump all of that stuff. Oh, and there was this terrible clatter of coins, and it was wonderful. I mean, I thought it was terrific. You know, a sign, that's a sound that we should not insulate ourselves against. And considerations of practicality or efficiency, those are not the, or even sanitation, those are not the first considerations in worship. The first considerations in worship with, as regards these signs are, let us ask of that sign that it speak to us in its fullness first. You know, I mentioned the other day early baptisms. Primitive Christian baptisms were nude. The candidates, adults and kids, take off your clothes. Women taking off earrings, jewelry, letting down the hair, plunging in the water. Martin Luther much preferred baptism by immersion as a fuller sign. And I think he's right, it is a fuller sign. Come up on the other side dressed in a white robe, clothed in the righteousness of Christ. I mean, you've got some wonderful symbols there. And we ought to let that speak to us first, before we begin to say, well, it's not sanitary, or it's not efficient, or it's not practical, or whatever. Those considerations of practicality and efficiency and sanitation and so on, I suppose, will occupy our attention somewhere along the line, but not first. First, we ought to ask, what is the sign itself saying? And what is the sign itself trying to get across? And baptism is a dunking, it's a drowning, it's a washing, has all of those wonderful associations. And three little dabs of moisture on a baby's brow, you know, I suppose we could say we've seen a valid baptism. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't show the fullness of the sign. Richard Kemmer, do you know that name, any of you? Wild man. At Leavenworth now, but he's a church designer and a church artist, and he speaks of the baptismal font, and he says, you go in most churches, Protestant churches, and you have to look, you have to search to find the baptismal font. When you finally find it, it's off in some dark corner somewhere. It's got a big wooden witch's hat cover. These are his words now. And it gives two men a hernia to take the cover off. And when you take the cover off, what do you discover? He says, an aluminum ashtray with a dead fly in the bottom. He says, that cannot possibly suggest the riches of baptism. So again, contemporary churches and even churches that are old that are being remodeled are getting great big fonts. Have you been to St. Peter's in New York City? At the foot of the Citicorp Tower. Any of you know that building? Oh, it's wonderful. Hugh Stebbins. Anyhow, it's modern architecture at its best. It sits at the foot of the Citicorp skyscraper, which has this chiseled top. You know, it's changed the skyline of Manhattan. But the skyscraper itself, the church arranged this, having owned the property, they could negotiate. The skyscraper has airspace 11 stories up above street level. And it's the whole skyscraper is on stilts. 11-story stilts, and the church is in that space underneath. And it's like a rock thrown at the base of the skyscraper, natural limestone or whatever, with stained glass all the way around like this. But why am I telling you this? Oh, the font. The font is huge. And you could dunk a baby. You could even dunk an adult. Any of you see the video? Is it called This Is the Night? Anyhow, it's about this Roman Catholic parish in Texas. And they do the Easter Vigil. And oh, do they do it. Wowee. They have a great huge font and they dunk their candidates. And they don't put a little dab of oil on their head. They pour oil over their hair. And oh, wonderful. Go ahead.
Where I am, there's been some movement toward pastors using a shell instead of their hand. And then a couple of churches back, the woman who had brought the shell from Florida had to deal with her because aren't you going to use the shell to dribble the water? And it was her, I didn't explain very well to her, I suppose, but I wanted to get into the water too.
Yeah, sure.
And be with it and splash it and have it there.
Sure.
And this little dribble with the shell seemed kind of what you were talking
a little too fuss budgety.
Yeah.
I have a shell, as a matter of fact.
From the child, almost.
Yeah. I have a wonderful, what do they call it, Chinese clam shell? I mean, it's a real shell from a real sea.
This was too.
And it's very handsome. And I use it especially for asperges, you know, for sprinkling.
Oh.
I put water in it, and then I have a little sprig of evergreen, and I go down the aisle, and I sprinkle people. So the shell has its use.
But there you aren't using it instead of your hand.
Yeah, there you might want, for baptism, you might want to use your hand. Or you might actually dunk them like the Orthodox do. Have you heard about that? Apparently Paul Harms at Trinity did this on one occasion. They had a big font at Trinity. And here's a little infant, which he baptizes the babies without a diaper, I mean naked, baptize it in the name of the Father and of the Son, and then the third time, in and out like this, head first. I mean, really covered with water. And apparently that's the way the Orthodox do it, too.
In connection with the shell, though,
they have even little sterling silver shells.
Well, I asked my friend early, Eric Heinzen, send me a bunch.
Uh-huh.
So each time a baptism, I could use the shell. This is yours.
Ooh, nice.
This is yours.
Each
of my grandchildren.
You make a good point, whatever works. I really like getting in the water with the kid, you know.
But there are very few
things. But you've got a nice thing going there, then why should I make rules for you or you for me?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that I think there's another step that can be taken with the shell that can become the permanent...
A gift from the church to the people, yeah.
Permanent certificate. Uh-huh.
I've also heard of a church where they make a new banner every time at baptism, with the baby's or the person's name on it, and present that to the...
We don't give the banner to...
Let's talk.
...the people, but it's big, and it's got your child's name.
Oh, a whole lot of children's names.
Well, it changes for whoever's being baptized.
I thought maybe it was a cumulative thing. That would be nice, too.
There was one church where we had that. Every child was added to this big banner.
Wow.
But what you said is neat, too.
Your baptism is wonderful, because it's...
Yeah.
That has the symbol of the shell on it, the baptized child of God in your son's name or whatever.
I baptize adults, too, by... kind of a combination of immersion and pouring. I was describing this primitive baptism naked in a sermon before the baptism was to take place, and we were to baptize a young woman from the choir who had on a choir robe. And in this church, it was a black choir robe with a zipper. And she came forward to be baptized after the sermon was over, and she took her zipper, and there was this palpable gasp in the congregation. As a matter of fact, she had a leotard on underneath, but they were ready for...
You wouldn't want to spoil the robe.
Yeah, I mean, you want to be prudent, I suppose, but I would love to see a baptism. They used to do this baptism down in Railroad Creek here at Holden Village. Pastor and people, right, and this old regular Baptist church that I speak of in Kentucky. As I say, five sermons, the shortest one about 7 minutes, the longest one about 25 minutes. But if you gave your life to Jesus in the middle of that sermon, they'd stop everything and take you right down to the water. There was a little creek flowing by, and concrete steps down to the water, just like the Jordan, you know, they have the tourist site now for
the new
River Jordan.
On sacraments. Suggests that infant baptism might take place at the very beginning.
At the beginning of the service, yeah. Makes a lot of sense.
Baptism after the confession of faith.
Yeah. I've frequently done that with children. For one thing, it gets it over with, and the parents can, you know, if the baby's fussy, the parents can come and go easily then. Taking the place of the confession.
I had a couple who had to have their baptism on the day that we had scheduled for confirmation.
Oh, boy.
Because they had people coming from other part of the country. And we had a very lovely service of baptism and affirmation of baptism.
You can combine them.
It didn't repeat all the pieces, but kind of...
Sure.
Merge
them together. Right. Wonderful.
And it was...
Apparently last week here, I wasn't here. Any of you here last week? They did an affirmation of baptism at Village Center. I think they might even have sprinkled.
But usually when we do affirmation of baptism, we don't do baptism. It was kind of neat to do them all in one service.
There's kids here this week who were baptized and confirmed on the same day.
Yeah.
They're 13 years old or something.
Well, you're living in an exciting time, friends.
Is there any inclination to encourage weddings taking place in the middle of...
On Sunday morning, yeah. Henry Horn.
One, and I've...
Yeah, I've done at least once. I've had a baptism on Sunday, or a wedding on Sunday morning.
Ours was.
Oh, really?
My dad's a pastor. He hoped the tradition would catch on, but...
Keep at it. Don't give up.
I had the bread, and then the bride and the groom each had a chalice.
Oh, wonderful.
Congregation came by.
Lovely, lovely.
Wow.
Very nice.
On a different subject, your comments about all the paperwork that we have to juggle, and that frustrates me terribly too. But what thoughts do you have in terms of helping newcomers? Because that's something we're also very concerned about, and that's one of the reasons for the paperwork. But I wish there were something easier than...
We have to train the people in the pew to be sensitive to strangers.
Yeah.
That's one of the things, and help them find the place in the book and that kind of thing. I think it's helpful if the bulletin is laid out in such... If you have a bulletin, is laid out in such a way that it makes it user friendly, including, as I said the other day, such things as using the terminology in our book. Again, our book is Holy Communion; it's not Eucharist. And you put in the bulletin Holy Eucharist, what's that? You know, I don't see that in the table of contents. It's a good word, Eucharist. Right. There's nothing wrong with it. But our term is Holy Communion, and I think we should use the designations. What's the worship leader on Sunday morning? Not liturgist, friends. Presiding minister. All of those terms, I was part of the committee that had to oversee yes or no on the Green Book. And, oh, we met for months, and there were stacks of stuff to look through. But those terms were chosen with very great care. And as I have said, they invite you to examine your piety. And in some cases, they challenge your piety. We always used to do it the other way. Well, this is a little different now.
I was at a church recently where I thought did something that I don't see very often. They did the order of service to the two sides of the insert page.
Hmm.
So you put that in in the Book of Worship. The announcements are all in the rest of the folder.
Mm-hmm. Aha.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we so why often, not? Yeah. The first page has got to be the liturgy.
And I know a hotshot pastor who has one of these trifold bulletins, it's like this, but he has his design in such a way that when you stick it in the bulletin, here's the outline sticking out from the pages. You know what I mean? I'm very clever.
I suppose we wouldn't have to use the insert that has the scriptures written on it so people actually looked at the person.
Yes, get away. Take Bibles out of the pew. Yeah. Do not have Bibles in the pew and do not use Celebrate that prints the scriptures. Yeah. They should be giving attention to the person who's reading. Mm-hmm.
Well, you talk about getting rid of paper. That's exactly what some of these fast show churches are doing. I mean, they project the music up there.
Yeah, right, I've seen that.
As one who kind of likes to sing,
I
don't like to be left without that little clue about what the music is. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes I don't know the music, but I can learn faster with that.
Seeing it, yeah, sure.
And
overhead projector type of thing.
Technology is a problem.
It's got its place, and you're talking to a guy who has two hearing aids and an artificial heart.
But some of these people have not been taught to talk to the back wall. Yeah.
And that's one of the problems when you have members of the congregation doing a fair bit of the service, reading or something like that. No matter how hard you try, you're going to get some people up there who whisper. It's the best you can say. The PA system saves you.
We ought to try to train them, to project.
Yeah, yes.
And train pastors to project their voice and do away with the mics.
I do struggle with that business of printing the lessons, because I know it ought to be the spoken word and that's what it really was. But when I've served a church that has a lot of older people who don't hear very well, and they say, but I understand it better when I can see the words, I wonder, if we're...
Maybe it has its place.
There's a handicap-friendly thing going on there, too. So
maybe.
I'm not sure.
There's no free lunch.
I like to go back and look at that text sometimes during...
I have people who take it home.
I tell people to take it home and look at it during the week.
Even during the sermon. Is that what really is there?
When the sermon gets boring.
No,
I know what you mean.
Challenging.
Yeah, sure.